the title of your book is pretty self-explanatory. Why seeking asylum is legal and Australia's policies are not. Okay, so let's start with the first part of that. Why seeking asylum is legal?
Under international law, every person has the right to seek asylum from persecution or other forms of serious harm. So we wanted to reflect that in the title of the book. And then moving on to the second part, allude to the fact that a number of Australia's current policies and former policies as well are not in accordance with our international legal obligations.
Well, just before we get off the illegal bit, as you know, there's been a long and very convoluted debate about the use of the word illegal, and it gets quite pedantic on one level in terms of when you can and can't use it. Do you say that there are no circumstances in which the government can call people illegal?
The confusion, I think, comes from the language of Article 31 of the Refugee Convention. And what it says is that no asylum seeker should be penalised for their illegal entry or presence. And that's why the government uses the term illegal. Essentially, what it's saying, though, is kind of the opposite of what Australia's policies do. So we detain people as a mandatory policy if they arrive without a visa or other required documentation. As people know, of course, the policy now then mandates transfer to Nauru or Papua New Guinea, which are precisely the kinds of penalties that the Refugee Convention itself says you're not allowed to impose on somebody who comes without the requisite travel documents.
So just to clear that up, you're saying that the convention says that it is illegal to enter the country in this way, but that no penalty should ever be applied.
Essentially, it recognises that some countries impose immigration requirements, like you need to have a valid visa. But it says precisely because the nature of refugee flight is such that people may flee without documents, they may not have documents because the very fact they're at risk of persecution by the government means they're hardly about to present themselves and apply for them. So if you like, it's the exception to the normal rule that you need to arrive with documents.
So part two of your title is Australia's policies are not legal. Why not?
Well, the reason is that a number of our policies, for example, mandatory detention, certain aspects of temporary protection, the conditions of detention, pushbacks and so on, are not consistent with Australia's obligations under international law.
What about Australian law?
Well, as the book explains, what we are seeking to do is situate Australia's policies in light of our international legal obligations. There are certainly questions as to whether certain policies, and of course there are many, are consistent with Australian law as well. But our argument is that even some of our legislation is at odds with the obligations we've voluntarily signed up to under international law. And those obligations are not only things that we owe to individuals, but they're also contractual obligations, if you like, that we've contracted into with other countries. So when we don't live up to those obligations, we're actually breaking promises to the rest of the international community.
So what does that mean? If we are breaking laws that we've signed up to with the international community, is there anything the international community can do about it?
That's a question I'm often asked, and my favourite response comes from a famous British barrister who, when asked, is international law real, said, well, the $1 million governments pay me each year to defend their rights under international law suggests they think it is. And I think that even though in the refugee space we don't have a refugee court per se, there are certainly mechanisms by which Australia can be called to account, and indeed has been. So, for instance, the UN Human Rights Committee on many occasions now has found that Australia is violating its obligations under human rights law, most notably in the context of its mandatory detention policy. And in a recent decision late last year, the UN Human Rights Committee not only found that mandatory detention itself was a breach of international law because it was arbitrary, there's no end period to it, it's not reviewable by a court, and so on. They also found that in certain circumstances, that detention can constitute inhuman or degrading treatment, which is a very serious finding.
But we have seen in recent years and even months people sentenced for crimes against humanity in Cambodia and crimes, war crimes in, say, the Balkans War. Is there any punishment that can accrue to a country or members of its government from breaches of this kind of law?
There are mechanisms. For instance, another country could take Australia before the International Court of Justice, as we did with Japan in the recent whaling case. That has not happened before in the context of refugee law, but certainly it could. But of course, you can't throw a whole country into jail for violating international law, which is why it relies on countries implementing their obligations in good faith, and also relies on the fact that most nations are embarrassed at the international level if they are found to be breaching those obligations. And I think it's important to recognise that right now there is a lot of concern, dismay, bewilderment even among the international community at Australia's response to asylum seekers and refugees, which we need to bear in mind relative to the rest of the world is a very, very tiny problem, and Australia's response is highly disproportionate to the numbers of people that we receive.
But as I'm sure you know, there are lots of people in Australia who say, damn the rest of the world, we should have our own policy.
Unfortunately for people who think that way, that's not the way international law works. And as I mentioned before, and as we explain in the book, international law isn't something imposed on Australia from the outside, but it's something that Australia has voluntarily accepted. And I think we also need to remember that in everyday life, international law functions perfectly well all the time. If you ring someone overseas, you post a letter overseas, you buy a product from overseas, all of that requires a whole lot of international law behind it. Of course, the only time it hits the headlines really is when something goes wrong.
But what about further down the track? Is there anything in international or national law that could end up meaning that Australia has to pay out large sums of money, for instance, as a result of actions that are happening now?
Certainly, if we look at some of our domestic legal frameworks, there have already been challenges under domestic law, for example, in the context of false imprisonment or negligence, those sorts of claims. And my understanding is there have been quite significant payouts. Most of the time, those cases have been settled. So we've never actually seen the courts themselves have to make a final judgment on those points. But if we think
that's within the domestic context, what about, say, if there were cases where people were sent back to Syria and ended up being tortured?
There'd be question. I mean, certainly in terms of responsibility, there it could well be found to be a breach. The difficulty can come then back to, at the international level, what the remedy is.
So and if it's international law, those people might end up having no real recourse.
Well, certainly the issue with the UN Human Rights Committee, I mentioned a number of their cases before, the decision by that committee can't mandate the Australian government to do anything particular. I mean, it sets out what the Australian government is obliged to do, but the sticking point then is the mechanism to force their hand. And so in a number of cases, the Australian government's response has been to say, we take a different view from the committee sitting in Geneva, and therefore we don't feel we do need to amend our legislation or publicly educate people about the breach and the law and human rights standards and so on, which are some of the things that the Human Rights Committee says ought to be done. And in another case, for instance, where Sweden was found to be in breach of returning someone to torture, the government there was highly embarrassed by that and went to great lengths to try and explain why that was an aberration and it was not the practice of Sweden to do that ordinarily.
But embarrassment might be the highest level of punishment.
But I think it may be in some cases, not necessarily always, but I think we shouldn't underestimate the value of or the impact of that. And I think Australians
but
should...
We know that there are governments around the world that are unembarrassable. There are government leaders who've been indicted for war crimes. I'm the leader of Sudan, for example. You can't get much more unembarrassable than that.
I think the difference, though, is that Australians like to think they live in a human rights respecting, democratic, law-abiding country that respects the rule of law, and that also wants to be in a position whereby our leaders can call other governments to account when they see very serious crimes and violations being committed. And I think we don't want to be in a position where any comments like that look like sheer hypocrisy.